Just a quick note before we get started. Some of the concepts in today's episode will be tough to visualize, so we recommend checking out these terms on the United States Geological Survey, or USGS, website. We've linked to these resources and some fantastic images from our guest, Dr. Romanovich, in the show notes. Check them out! For the last 100 years, two major earthquakes have held the attention of San Franciscans. It's 1906, and you're fast asleep. At 5:12 in the morning, a great force jolts awake you and the San Francisco Bay Area. You run outside as your house crumbles around you, only to see your neighbor across the street suddenly move 30 feet horizontally to your right, the length of six grown men. You try to stay on your feet as the earth violently heaves underneath you. Buildings topple, roads crack, and deadly fires erupt as gas lines rupture. Suddenly, everything falls still. And it's barely been 60 seconds. The world has fallen down around you, and the city will burn for the next 3 days. From just under 1 minute of seismic activity, over 80% of the city has been utterly destroyed, and over 3,000 people have died. 80 years later, it's the Battle of the Bay. The San Francisco Giants and Oakland Athletics are getting ready to face off in Game 3 of the 1989 Major League Baseball World Series.
At second base, so the Oakland A's take.
I'll tell you what, we're having an earthquake.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Hi, and welcome back to Carry the One Radio. My name is Anna, and I'm a neuroscientist. Ever since I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, I keep hearing about how we're overdue for the next big earthquake. But I've never really understood what that means. How do scientists know when earthquakes are supposed to happen? And come to think of it, what exactly is an earthquake? How do we study them? And what can we learn from earthquakes besides just knowing when to take cover? Along the same lines, what other natural phenomena like volcanoes can we study and learn from? To help us understand these questions, we traveled across the San Francisco Bay to the University of California, Berkeley, to learn from geophysicist Dr. Barbara Romanovich.
I'm a professor in the graduate school here at UC Berkeley, and I'm also actually a professor at the Collège de France in Paris, where I hold the chair of physics of the Earth's interior. I was the director of the Berkeley Seismolab for 20 years, and then I stepped down and retired from teaching, but I still have a research lab. Mm-hmm. The Berkeley Seismolab, it's an organized research unit. It has a mission, which is to monitor earthquakes in Northern California, which we do together with the U.S. Geological Survey on the other side of the bay.
Before we dive into earthquakes and earthquake detection, though, let's go over a few basics. So, I know we're all sitting right here on this big chunk of rock we like to call Earth, but what exactly makes up the Earth? It might be a chunk of rock, but it's not solid rock. It's more like a cake made up of distinct layers. Let's have Dr. Romanovich situate us.
So first of all, the Earth's radius is 6,371 kilometers. Scientific, exactly. And of that, as you go deeper, you first have a crust, which is on average about 30 kilometers thick. It's very, very thin, right? It's thinner in the oceans where the crust is formed. In the old continents, it can reach 50, 60 kilometers. In fact, the thickest crust is under Tibet. It reaches about 70 kilometers.
So, as Dr. Romanovich just said, the radius of the Earth is 6,371 kilometers. If you were to travel that distance along the surface of the Earth rather than straight through it, that's about the distance from San Francisco to Iceland. The Earth's crust, at its thickest, is only 70 kilometers, or 43 miles, not even the length of two marathons. So that means that the crust is just about 1% of the entire radius of the Earth. If the Earth were an apple, the crust would only be about as thick as the apple's skin.
Then we have the upper mantle. In the middle description, we have a crust mantle boundary, about 30 kilometers depth. Then you have what we call the upper mantle, which is down to 660 kilometers depth, at which depth you have one of these phase changes. I mean, I don't know how much you want to detail you want, but there are places in the mantle where, as you compress these crystal structures, all of a sudden they can't be compressed anymore, and so they change into a different kind of structure. It's still the same atoms, but they're configured differently in a high pressure phase. And that happens at a particular pressure, particular temperature.
So just beneath that thin crust, the next layer is called the mantle. It's a lot thicker than the crust. To give you a sense of scale, if San Francisco were the crust, this phase change would be in Las Vegas. We still have a lot more distance to go to journey to the center of the Earth. And between the upper mantle and the lower mantle, there's something funky going on. Geophysicists call it a phase change, and it's where the minerals that make up the mantle change form, or change their crystal structure. This is because they are under enormous pressure. It's sort of similar to the difference between graphite, like what's in your pencil lead, and diamond. Both are made up of the same element, carbon, but pressure changes the way the molecules of carbon are arranged to make one or the other. At this 660 kilometer deep boundary, you have the same minerals on either side of the boundary, but their structure and their behavior is different. So what do we mean by behavior? Well, movement, for one. The lower mantle is not static. It's moving and flowing around, and the crust and upper mantle together essentially float on top of this moving bed of molten rock, like ice floating on top of a lake. The mantle flows in patterns of convection, with hotter parts of the mantle floating up towards the crust and colder parts sinking down lower. It's the same thing that happens to the air in your oven if you use the convection bake setting, but a lot hotter.
And then you have the lower mantle, and at the core mantle boundary, it's the boundary between the silicate rock mantle and the fluid core, which is made primarily out of iron in fluid form.
So we've got the thin crust, we've got the flowing mantle, and next, the core. At the boundary between the upper and lower mantle, we saw a change in the structure of the minerals that make up the mantle, but no change in the minerals themselves. At the core mantle boundary, though, we do start to see different minerals. The mantle is mostly silicate rock, but the core is made up of iron. The outer core is liquid iron, and the inner core, again due to pressure, is solid iron.
Which is 1,200 kilometers in radius. Core mantle boundary is at 3,480 kilometers in radius, and the solid inner core is almost pure iron.
And it's solid because of the pressure
and temperature. Yes, you go through another phase change, but this one, a liquid to solid, as the pressure increases, basically crystallizes.
So the inner core is as wide as nearly the length of California, or 770 miles. And the core mantle boundary is at 3,480 kilometers, the distance from San Francisco to Atlanta. If we zoom out again, that means that about half of the radius of the Earth is made up of the mantle. At this point, you might be thinking, wait a second, there's no way we can get all the way down to the inner core if it's surrounded by liquid iron. How do we actually know that those are the different layers of the Earth? And how do we know what materials these different layers are? Could we drill into the Earth to see what it's made of?
The deepest hole that was ever drilled is about 12 and something kilometers.
So you don't even break the crust?
No, not in most places. In fact, it was drilled in the continent because it's easier to drill in the continent than it is in the ocean. Even though the crust is much thinner, you know, like 5 kilometers or less in the oceans, it's very hard to get a drill. And it's really hard rock. And so they failed. They just haven't been able to, because as the drill bit gets heated up, it's very hard to cool it, and so it melts, and you know, just technologically very difficult. Yeah, so we can't go inside, so we image, you know, that's actually my business.
We can't drill through the crust, even that first apple skin layer of the Earth. So we have to be crafty to study what the inside of the Earth is made of. One way to study this is to look at the gases and rocks that come out of volcanoes. Another is imaging. Dr. Romanovich is an expert in this method, except instead of taking pictures of the Earth, she uses seismic waves.
So most of my research right now is on imaging the Earth's interior, so using seismic waves that are generated by earthquakes that propagate through the Earth and get picked up by instruments all over the world. As they propagate through the Earth, they change the speed at which they propagate, depending on what kind of structures they encounter, whether the structures are physically hotter or colder, etc. And so, just like you can image the brain, right? It's very similar, except we use seismic waves instead of whatever waves you use for the human body.
You've had an X-ray, right? Or maybe a CT scan? X-rays are electromagnetic waves, part of the spectrum of light. The way that an X-ray can visualize bones has to do with how well these waves can pass through all the different materials of your body, like bones and muscle and skin. Dr. Romanovich uses the same principles in her imaging work, but instead of using light waves to take pictures of the inside of the body, she uses seismic waves to take pictures of the inside of the Earth. Well, seismic waves and a healthy dose of modeling. Dr. Romanovich and her team record these waves, waveform, amplitude, frequency, and fit these measurements into their models. Ultimately, this is how they model what makes up the Earth's center, since, as we talked about earlier, the mineral makeup of different layers will alter how the waves travel. From there, any discrepancies between the model and the recorded waves will be used to improve our understanding of the Earth's interior, like how the very center of the Earth was discovered to be solid rather than liquid iron.
And so we record them, and then we measure how long, we kind of recognize where they've been through. And we measure their arrival time, and we compare them to a model. And the differences tell us what's wrong with our model.
So remember, seismic waves which travel through the Earth are most commonly caused by earthquakes.
When an earthquake happens, it's basically a rupture over something that's like a plane. And as the plane ruptures, it generates vibrations, gives an impulse, which then gets propagated. Like in the water, right? You drop a stone in the water and you have waves that move out from there. That's, or like a boat, creates waves. Same idea, except it's an earthquake that gives it a jolt and then the waves propagate through the Earth.
So instead of sending electromagnetic X-rays, Dr. Romanovich is using the movement of earthquake-generated seismic waves.
How far do waves generated by earthquakes generally propagate? Do you need an earthquake to be relatively local to that place?
Depends how big it is. If it's a very small earthquake, you need to observe it locally. So a magnitude 5 earthquake is observable at the other end of the world. And then the larger the earthquake, the stronger the waves will be on your recording.
But when seismic waves move through the Earth, they don't just move in a straight line. They're bumped around by the different materials they run into on the way. Sometimes they can pass through a material, but sometimes they're bounced back out to the surface of the Earth. We'll get more into the concepts and types of waves involved in a second, but let's talk through the big picture.
Okay, so the different waves have different paths. So some of them will stay in the mantle. Some of them will stay in the mantle but reflect on the surface once or twice, three times. Some of them will reflect on the core mantle boundary. And some of them will dive into the core and then reappear somewhere further. The reason why we know, and we've known this since 1910, that there is a fluid core is because the shear waves don't propagate fluids. So you end up having a shadow zone, the shear wave goes to the core mantle boundary and can't get through. It has to convert to compression wave, but then it dives deeper again because of the laws of refraction and the velocities. And so it appears much further away. The deeper it dives, the further it goes.
Okay, so this is where things get a bit tricky. To understand the laws of refraction that Dr. Romanovich mentioned, let's think about a straw in a glass of water. Got an image in your head? Great. If you look carefully, the straw looks like it bends at the surface between the water and the air. But the straw's not actually bent. It's really just a trick of the light. The light waves that pass from the top of the straw, outside the water, pass directly to your eye without bending. On the other hand, the waves coming from the straw underwater bend as they pass through the boundary of water and air. This is because light travels at different speeds in water and in air. Similarly, in the core of the Earth, seismic waves travel at different speeds through different materials. As these seismic waves pass from the mantle into the core, they speed up dramatically and end up much farther away on the surface of the Earth than would be expected with a liquid core. This means that even for an earthquake large enough to be detected around the world, there are certain parts of the world that just won't see it because of the bending of seismic waves in the Earth's core. That area where waves don't propagate is called the shadow zone. This shadow zone is actually a very specific region from 104 to 140 degrees away from the epicenter, or origin, of an earthquake. There's a great and video explanation on the USGS website, which we've linked in the show notes. So, earthquakes can tell us a lot about what this planet we all live on is made of deep down. But for a lot of us, especially in the Bay Area, when we think of earthquakes, we want to know how they're going to affect us. How can we apply what we know from imaging and modeling seismic waves to understanding and predicting earthquakes? Unfortunately, earthquakes are really hard to predict. Volcanoes and weather-based natural disasters are easier to predict and prepare for, but earthquakes give only seconds of warning at most. Let's talk through the basics of how earthquake detection and prediction can work. So, like Dr. Romanovich mentioned earlier, earthquakes generate seismic waves, which come in two different flavors.
You've seen records of sound waves. They are like sound waves, but so there's two kinds of waves that go through the Earth. There's compressional waves, which are like sound waves, and then there's shear waves, which don't propagate through air, so there's no equivalent.
Compressional and shear waves are the basis of earthquake detection systems. Let's imagine a slinky that is stretched out along the floor, with one end in your hand and the other fixed in place. A compressional wave would be like if you pushed, or compressed, your end of the slinky towards the other, and then quickly jerked it back. That would create a wave that moves in the direction of the slinky movement, or particle movement in the crust. Shear waves, on the other hand, are like if you instead moved one end of the slinky from side to side. The wave still moves down the slinky, but now it's perpendicular to the particle movement. These waves move through the slinky and the Earth at different speeds, with compressional waves moving faster than shear waves. The words compressional and shear describe the forces that generate these two types of waves. But when we're talking about earthquake detection, it's more helpful to talk about the speeds of these two waves. So from here on out, we'll call compressional waves P waves, since they're the primary waves to be detected, and we'll call shear waves S waves for being detected second.
And so early warning is based on this property, is that you put a detector close to where an earthquake happens. As soon as it detects the P wave, you can send a warning at some distance. Say, let's take the Loma Prieta earthquake, which happened in 1989 in the Santa Cruz Mountains, okay? Say you had some detectors there, then you can send a warning to San Francisco. You know, basically, you could get about 10 seconds warning before the S wave arrives. And the shear waves are the ones that destroy buildings because they have a lot of horizontal motions, and buildings are primarily built to withstand gravity. So, you know, vertical. Of course, they withstand winds, but the energy from a shear wave is much more than they're built for in general. Right. So that's what kills people.
Imagine a stack of books. If you wiggle the book at the bottom, the whole stack would sway, right? But it won't necessarily collapse unless there's enough force, like really shaking the bottom book. So P waves are this low energy wiggle that makes buildings sway, but S waves are the high energy shove that topples the stack. If you want to predict when an earthquake is going to happen, you want to be able to pick up the low energy wiggle, the P wave, before the destructive but slower S wave arrives. It actually doesn't take super fancy tech to be able to detect a P wave. Dr. Imanovic showed us the earthquake detector she keeps in her office, which looks like two Jenga blocks stacked on top of each other lengthwise.
It takes time and it's not going to fall immediately. Yeah. You see, there's a delay. And so if you have an instrument, which is, of course, connected to the ground, and then you have like a platform, and then you have a spring and a mass on the spring, as you move the ground, the mass will not move for a little bit, right? The ground will move, mass will not be.
That clattering you hear is the top Jenga block falling onto the table. The bottom block is pushed by a force, either Dr. Imanovic pushing the table or an earthquake jolting the ground underneath. But the top block doesn't move for a second, and so it falls as the bottom block moves out from under it.
So you can record the differential motion between the mass and the ground. The seismometer is basically a mass and a spring. It's more complicated in detail, but anyways. And then in the old times, you would record on paper, you know, on photographic paper, etc. With a drum, right? That's the classical picture. And nowadays, we record digitally.
Not all seismic activity is generated by earthquakes, though. Anything that causes movement in the Earth's crust will cause waves that can be picked up by seismometers. This includes other natural phenomena, like landslides and volcanoes.
You can have landslides, right, which are not on faults, but they also generate, like, give a jolt, and so they generate seismic waves.
And increasingly, even human activity can cause earthquakes, too. One of the ways we harvest natural gas and petroleum is through a process called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, where high-pressure fluids are forced into fissures in the crust to release gas and oil.
So, for example, in Oklahoma, there used to be practically no earthquakes, and now they have lots. Small ones, right? But I think they had one big one, more than magnitude 5. Now, whether these earthquakes would have happened eventually or not, I mean, whether you're adding to the tectonic stress or really creating a stress from scratch, it's probably just added on to existing tectonics, which makes it go over the threshold.
The injection of fluid into the crust, whether for fracking, wastewater disposal, or something else, triggers seismic activity in dormant and previously unknown faults. While most of the activity manifests as micro-earthquakes that aren't usually detected or felt, fluid injections did cause a 5.8 magnitude earthquake in 2011 in Oklahoma. And there has been a tremendous increase in the number of magnitude 3 to 4 quakes in the central United States, where they were considered rare, from 867 between 1973 and 2008 to now over 3,600 in the last decade alone. But fracking might lend some insight into a peculiar puzzle, earthquakes that occur much deeper in the earth than we expect.
Dr. Imanovic showed us a color map of seismic activity compared to depth in the Earth.
So this is seismicity of the world. You can see most of it is shallow, and they delineate the plate boundaries. These are the mid-ocean ridges, and then the subduction zones here. But then you see these blue colors. These are regions where you have earthquakes all the way down to in excess of 600 kilometers. We don't quite understand why we have earthquakes that deep. It doesn't make sense from the point of view of what we know about brittle fracture. Fractures should not be brittle, even in these colder regions. One possibility is dehydration.
Most seismic activity happens solidly in the crust, in the first 30 kilometers or so. But there are earthquakes that happen as deep as 600 kilometers, far deeper than geophysicists would expect. So, if hydraulic fracking, the process of forcing fluid into dehydrated rock, can cause earthquakes, this might help to explain why some earthquakes can be generated way further down than would otherwise be expected. So, back to earthquake early detection. Right now, our early detection systems can only give us about 10 seconds of advance notice to hide under a table, because that's about how much sooner P waves will arrive than S waves. But can we lengthen that warning time? There are a couple of interesting ideas about how else we could measure seismic activity to give us more notice, especially in fault regions like the San Francisco Bay Area, where we're overdue for another big earthquake.
There is now a suggestion that when a really big earthquake happens, but they have to be like really huge, like magnitude 8, like the San Francisco 1906 or bigger, you know, like the Japan earthquake, the Fukushima earthquake, that you may be able to detain the gravity change. And gravity is instantaneous, right? The gravity field is change should be instantaneous in whole of space. So if you can detect the gravity change somehow, you could actually beat the P wave.
You heard her. A big earthquake could change gravity.
But it's based on observations that were made for the Fukushima earthquake. It's a very specific direction of observation with direction angle. It's very specific distances. They can see something like that. So it's very new. And it's not completely clear that you can use it for early warning.
The shifting of enormous tectonic plates actually results in a shift of the Earth's internal mass, which can theoretically provide even earlier warning than P waves. But, as Dr. Armandovich cautions, this observation has been made only once, after the Fukushima earthquake in 2011. Moreover, it's a change that comes to about 1/1,000,000,000 of the Earth's total gravity, even for the strongest earthquakes. And our current technology isn't sensitive enough for that. While gravity shifts could be instrumental in detecting and preparing for large earthquakes, there is still an enormous amount of work to be done before, or even if, it gets integrated into early detection systems. There's another factor with earthquake detection, though. It's all well and good to know when one is coming, but we also need to know how big it will be, because we don't need warnings for tiny earthquakes that won't cause much damage.
So you want to make sure that what you're detecting is large enough before you send a warning. And that's a tricky one, because it's a fundamental scientific question. Do earthquakes know how big they're going to be when they start? Or what is the physical mechanism? Or is it that the rupture starts and then it gets carried away and becomes very big? Propagates along a longer distance? Or is it something that already at the beginning you know that there's something special about it because there was a preparation zone that we can't figure out right now that tells you it's going to be big? And you want to be able to say it as fast as possible. And so there's a lot of discussion, you know, how much can you say about an earthquake when you're looking only first few wiggle? So it's a challenge.
Modern technology means modern solutions. Enter the Global Positioning System, better known as GPS. How I compensate for my terrible sense of direction, and actually another way geophysicists might someday be able to predict earthquakes.
Because you know how GPS works, measurement of relative distance using satellite ranging. If you have a GPS several GPS stations near the epicenter, you will rapidly know more about the earthquake because it just detects directly the displacement. So that's also now being explored. And if you can use it, how can you use it to help early warning and to help determine the magnitude?
That work, figuring out how to use GPS for earthquake detection, will take some time. But GPS can be used to measure fault activity. By measuring the physical displacement of GPS stations along a fault line, researchers can assess which faults are moving and how much strain is accumulating. That's how we know that the Bay Area is due for another big earthquake. Since the 1906 earthquake, there has been a lot of slippage and stress accumulated at the San Andreas Fault. Contrary to popular belief, small earthquakes don't actually lessen the probability of experiencing a big one. The U.S. Geological Survey has predicted that the area will experience an earthquake of at least magnitude 6.7 before 2030. With that in mind, it's easy to understand why improving our earthquake detection systems is so important. Sure, we need enough warning to take cover before an earthquake hits, but it would be better to have a sense of when that will be. We're recording this episode in July 2020, and no one knows if that big earthquake will hit later this year or at the end of the decade. As it is, though, earthquakes are one of the hardest natural disasters to predict, and that's in part because we don't understand enough about what other factors might predict earthquakes. Maybe that's because we don't understand enough about the Earth itself. So far, we've talked a lot about earthquakes, what they are, and how we study them. While we have covered some of what they teach us about the Earth, we need to include what we've learned from other natural disasters, namely volcanoes. One of the most important concepts in geology that has come from studying these phenomena is the theory of plate tectonics. This is the idea that the Earth's crust and upper mantle are not a single continuous piece. Instead, they're broken into several huge sections called tectonic plates that creep over the fluid lower mantle. Plates interact with each other at plate boundaries, and these interactions are classified as convergent, divergent, or transform. That's plates coming together, pulling away, or slipping past each other. Convergent plate boundaries are like the Indian subcontinent crashing into Asia and forming the Himalayan mountain range. Divergent boundaries can be found in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, as new seafloor spews up and separates Europe and Africa from the Americas. And finally, transform boundaries are like the San Andreas Fault just off the coast of San Francisco. These occur when two tectonic plates slip past each other horizontally. Now, a fault is any break in the crust. Not all faults cut through the upper mantle as well. Smaller faults tend to form around plate boundaries. The San Andreas Fault Zone is home to many smaller faults in the area, whose movements are classified in their own ways. These are dip-slip faults, where one block of crust drops down relative to the other, strike-slip faults, where they slide past each other, and subduction faults, where one moves down and below the other. The San Francisco Bay Area is a strike-slip zone. That is, the faults in this area grind past each other. And there are physical indications of this all over the area. Take the California Memorial Stadium on the University of California Berkeley's campus, where Dr. Romanovich works. It sits right on top of the Hayward Fault and is a great example of strike-slip movement.
Now, motions of tectonic plates are on average 5 centimeters a year. You know, in 30 years' time, you can start seeing, you know, like a curb, the stadium deform, or the curb, there's a street called Dwight here, where you can see the curb deforming. And over a decade or 30 years, you can really see it.
Which is a very small amount of time on the geological timescale of thousands, if not millions of years. If you look further back than 30 years, maybe tens of millions of years instead, California would have looked a lot different.
You can have plate reorganizations. You know, there used to be subduction zones here. For example, you can see offset volcanic centers where one half is in Los Angeles and another half is somewhere here in the Bay Area.
These offset volcanoes are Pinnacles National Park here in Northern California and Ninoc Volcano in Southern California. Although we don't have volcanoes here anymore, we used to, and the remnants of those ancient volcanoes are still present in the Napa vineyards. Apparently, volcanic soil makes for great wine. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. So, as Dr. Romanovich mentioned, what's now the San Andreas Fault Zone used to be a subduction zone. That's where, at a plate boundary, one plate sinks down into the lower mantle. This generates an enormous amount of heat, melting the sinking plate into magma that gets pushed up towards the surface of the Earth. Of course, subduction zones do generate earthquakes, but they also create, you guessed it, volcanoes.
Yeah, so those volcanoes also occur. So on the mid-ocean ridges is because things are coming up rather lava. In subduction zones, as the thing goes down, it displaces a hot material and basically causes what's called partial melt of the plate, kind of mixed with whatever it encounters down there. And that causes volcanoes, usually about 100 kilometers depth.
We had the North American plate and the Pacific Plate, as we do today, but in between them, there was this ancient oceanic Farallon Plate. A very long time ago, the Farallon Plate began subducting under the North American Plate. Eventually, part of the Farallon Plate fused to the eastern edge of the Pacific Plate, and this ended the subduction and initiated horizontal shear movement instead. Thus, the San Andreas Fault, a strike-slip fault between the Pacific and North American plates, was born. So, as you can imagine, a lot of the action, geologically speaking, happens at plate boundaries. Earthquakes, mountains, volcanoes. Boundary volcanoes, like Ninoc, tend to mark the boundaries of current or historic tectonic plates. The Ring of Fire, the ring of volcanoes around the Pacific Plate, where the vast majority of volcanic activity occurs, is a direct consequence of tectonic subduction. To name just a few of those volcanoes, we have Mount St. Helens here in the US, Mount Fuji in Japan, Cotopaxi in Ecuador, Mount Erebus in the Antarctic, and Krakatoa in Indonesia. You might be wondering why we're talking about volcanoes in an episode about earthquakes. Well, just as seismic activity can tell us about the existence of a solid core, we can study the rock, minerals, and gas from volcanic eruptions to learn more about the composition of the Earth's interior. Like we mentioned earlier, this is how we know what the different layers of Earth are made of, since magma is composed of whatever minerals were melted by subducting plates. Studying volcanic activity, and by extension subduction, can also reveal clues about the Earth's past. Dr. Romanovich's imaging has revealed an exciting secret deep inside the Earth, though its evidence is visible here on the surface too, hotspot volcanoes. As we just discussed, most volcanoes can be found at the boundaries of tectonic plates, like the Ring of Fire surrounding the Pacific Plate. But if you look carefully, there are a few exceptions. Sometimes we see volcanoes in the middle of plates, not on their edges.
So the hotspot volcanoes, they are in the middle of tectonic plates, so they don't belong, quote-unquote, to the simple plate tectonic theory. So, for example, Hawaii. So Hawaii is in the middle of the Pacific Plate, and you don't expect from plate tectonics that there should be any volcanoes there, because you can't explain them by magma coming up or by a subduction. And so when plate tectonics was the kind of people got excited about it and accepted the theory 50 years ago, they had to find an explanation for these. And so there's not only is it in the middle of the plate, but it also has this line of volcanoes that are older and older in millions of years, the extinct volcanoes.
The Hawaiian island chain looks like a product of a volcanic source rooted somewhere below the crust that stays put while tectonic plates move over it, allowing volcanoes to build up and emerge from the ocean in an arc over time. These volcanoes are known as hotspot volcanoes because they don't belong to the simple plate tectonic theory, since they don't show up at boundaries. If you can pull out a map whenever you get a chance or look on Google Earth, you can even track these plumes from the Hawaiian Islands, traveling up to near Japan. The Hawaiian Islands mark the track of a hotspot over which the Pacific Plate has moved in a northwest direction towards Japan. The location of that plume is marked now by Lo'ihi, an underwater volcano just off the southeast corner of the Big Island of Hawaii.
As you go along in the direction of the plate motion, you have these older and older volcanoes. And that was explained by this idea, is that you have a plume rooted somewhere deep in the mantle that's fixed with respect to the plate motion. And so at this snapshot in time, you have a hotspot volcano right on top of this, right? And then the plate moves, this volcano becomes extinct, and another one forms.
But what is the source? If there aren't tectonic plates melting as they subduct under their neighbors at these points, what could be generating these hotspot volcanoes? It's actually been a matter of debate. These hotspot volcanoes might just be the result of holes in the lithosphere, or the crust and upper mantle. Hot material from the lower mantle might be leaking up, as if the lithosphere were being stretched thin in certain places. Or the hotspots could be the result of a deeper plume, originating at the core mantle boundary.
It is thought, and I will claim we can image them now, that they originate at the core mantle boundary. Basically, they originate from the fact that part of the heating comes from below, from the core. And when you heat a fluid from below, you will see this kind of plumes.
To visualize these plumes, Dr. Romanovich's group developed the first high-resolution 3D scan of the Earth's interior. Picture a tube of hot rock from the hotspot volcano's crater down into the Earth, which connects to the mantle. These huge plumes of super hot rock rise from the core mantle boundary and fan out, feeding the underground chambers of molten rock, which eventually show up on the surface as hotspot volcanoes.
People have been chasing after these plumes for a long time because that's what you expect to see in a fluid heated from below. You expect like plumes of material coming up. And the hotspot volcanoes have different chemistry in them also.
That's right. The materials that flow out of hotspot volcanoes are different than what is found in boundary volcanoes. And that means that both can give us insight into what materials lie inside the Earth, though maybe at different depths.
So, volcanoes and earthquakes both teach us about what's going on inside the Earth. But they're not always independent natural disasters from one another. For example, did you know volcanic activity can actually cause earthquakes?
In the case of volcanoes, you can have so-called volcanic earthquakes, which probably happen on faults, most of them. But there's also the notion that you have conduits right inside a volcano that allow the magma to rise from the magma chamber somewhere below to the surface. And that as the magma goes through this, it kind of dilates the conduits, and that causes earthquakes also. These earthquakes have different characteristics than the ones that occur on faults away from volcanoes. They usually are like tremors.
The seismic activity from volcanic earthquakes is used to monitor volcanoes and can be a strong indicator of an impending eruption. Earthquakes remain the hardest natural disaster to predict. Although geophysicists can use volcanic earthquakes to predict and prepare for volcanic eruptions, we haven't yet done the same for normal earthquakes. Learning about the Earth's interior through volcanoes, modern imaging, and modeling techniques can help us figure out how the Earth is changing below our feet, and how these changes, over a geological timescale, affect our world on the surface. Hopefully, this can help us better detect earthquakes in the future. Imagine the difference even 10 seconds would make.
This episode is written and produced by me, Anna Lipkin, Cindy Liu, and Kanchi Mehta, with help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. Thank you so much to Dr. Barbara Romanovich for speaking with us and providing visual aids for some of her work that we talked about in this episode. Head over to the show notes on our website at carrytheoneradio.com to check out those images and some helpful resources from the USGS. We also thank David Cabral, Janine Cuevas, Carly Van Orsdell, and Sama Ahmed for supporting us as science producers on our Patreon. You can be a science producer too by heading over to patreon.com/carrytheone and donating what you can. Otherwise, tell your friends about us, leave a review, find us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and start a conversation. We've got lots more content over on our website, and you can find all our episodes on your favorite podcast app. Stay tuned for more episodes and stay curious.